seeds are here. Seeds are there. Seeds are just about everywhere. And those seeds fuel most of humanity's today. For most of evolutionary history, seeds did not even exist. That fact leads us to ask today, how did seeds come to aid in the development of us cooking apes?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1061st edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends way up there in Findhorn who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
It is my pleasure to be here.
My question for you today, which plant's seeds feeds the most people? Is it corn, wheat, or rice?
All?
No, you got to make one guess. Corn, wheat, or rice?
Corn.
Right on. You yes. won. What'd you do? Pick the first one?
Yes.
Folks, seeds are quite literally the stuff and staff of life, supporting the diets and economies of civilizations, and yet for most of evolutionary history, they did not even exist. The evolutionary history of seeds shows not only how they were able to survive and prosper in nature, but also how they helped Homo sapiens to survive and prosper as well. Each seed comes prepackaged with a genetic blueprint for new life, as well as the first meal for that new life. That first meal also provides meals for humans and animal kind. In fact, seeds, grains, nuts, and pulses provide 3/4 of the calories and over half the protein in the human diet. Seeds also provide for cosmetics, fuel, lubricants, medicines, and paints. But for all those benefits to become realized via the industry of agriculture, mankind would have to master the storage and manipulation of dormant seeds. And to get enough smarts to get that job done, man would have to become the cooking ape. And so today we pause to ask, how did seeds come to aid in the development of us cooking apes? Here to help us explore the world of seeds, we have Tor Hansen, who is the PhD author of The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. Tor, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, thank you for having me on, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Oops. Somehow we lost him there.
I can still hear you, Michael.
Okay, I've got you back. I pressed the wrong button, as I occasionally do. Good thing I'm not flying an airplane. We'd probably be in the side of a mountain if I did. Well, Tor, let's see. Two Vikings on seeds today, an Olsen and a Hansen. As a conservation biologist, you've roamed Central America studying trees and songbirds. You've studied nest predation in Tanzania. You have vultures in Africa and seeds everywhere. Tor, I got to ask you, this doesn't sound like work to me.
Well, it's been quite a journey. It's been quite a journey, Michael, but I'm lucky enough to have been able to do field work in lots of places around the world, and that experience feeds into the writing that I do about natural history.
And, you know, the people who send you on these expeditions are some very noteworthy organizations, so that's how you get funded to do these, right? People give you grants and you go out and study things?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. I have had grants from different organizations like the National Science Foundation and what have you, and nowadays that I'm spending more of my time writing, I usually work on advances from my publisher.
Good to go. We always ask our guests who funds the way, and that way we have an understanding of where they're coming from. One of the most fascinating stories in your book, Seeds, incidentally, your book, Seeds, sat on my bookshelf for a long time, and it kept coming to the top of the book pile for some reason. And finally, for whatever reason, it germinated into this radio program. Is that not like some seeds?
Yes, lying dormant for a long period of time before they finally germinate and bear fruit. And here we are with the fruit.
And here we are with the fruit. Good to go. Tell us a little bit about your son, Noah, and his heeds.
Yeah, so this was something that occurred right when I was trying to decide what book to write next. I had just finished a book on the evolution of feathers, and I had a number of different topics in mind and was really struggling to make a decision on what to work on next. And at the time, my son was about 2 years old, and like a lot of kids his age, had a hard time pronouncing his S's. But instead of just developing a lisp, as many children do, he simply eliminated S's and replaced them with a hard H sound. So in combination with his fascination at that time, for reasons we've never quite understood, with seeds, and he was constantly taking apart apples and berries and other bits of fruit and pulling the seeds out and holding them up to me. So in combination with that fascination and his pronunciation, I was living with someone who was holding up handfuls of seeds to me every day and shouting, "Heed, heed, Papa."
So there you are. There's your subject, right? Simple as that.
I needed the seed. Yes, my subject became very clear.
So you never did figure out why he became so fascinated with seeds. Is he still fascinated with seeds? How old is he now?
Noah is now six, and he maintains his own area in our garden where right now he is tending some beautiful watermelon plants. So he does continue to be very interested in plants and seeds, but it was something that just began for reasons we don't understand. But when he was a very young child, he was just fascinated with the look and the feel and the idea of seeds. And then in some ways, maybe it's some sort of human trait. We've been so long associated with seeds, and I like to think that this was some atavistic urge in him that showed him that these things were interesting from the get-go.
Well, indeed, you know, much of his family, at least on your wife's side, were farmers and were seed savers and seed people. As though as a Viking, you of course were a fisherman, came from a fisherman background. But do you think that fascination with seeds could be passed through the genes?
Well, it's hard to know. But you certainly, if you look back at any of our history or the vast majority of us, you find that we're all farmers at heart. I mean, the agricultural revolution, the Neolithic revolution that took place for most cultures around the world, you know, starting around 14,000 years ago and then up sooner in some places, that transformation from largely hunter-gatherer to largely agricultural fundamentally shifted our attention to plants. The whole notion of culture is deeply tied to the idea of sowing and of harvest. The word itself comes to us from the Latin word cultura, which means the care bestowed upon plants. So we are farmers at heart, and I think that all of us have a deep cultural bond to seeds.
That would be akin to Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
That's a wonderful, wonderful way to put it. But it is fundamental to how we live, and we've been doing it for so long that we take it for granted. But the characteristics of seeds have allowed us to live upon them and to manipulate crops to feature the characteristics that we need, whether it's starches or proteins or something that grows in a particular climate. We can do that because of many of the unique characteristics of seeds.
Well, before we go to how we came to use seeds or how they came to use us, I'm not sure which is which, you talk a little bit about throughout evolutionary history, there were no seeds, or much of evolutionary history at least. How did the world get along before seeds?
Yeah, well, great question. And I knew when I started this project that I wanted the book to be called The Triumph of Seeds, because it really is a story ultimately of triumph. You know, seeds are everywhere now, but that wasn't always the case. For millions of years, it was the spore plants that dominated the terrestrial flora of this planet. You know, great forests of ferns and spike mosses and horsetails the size of trees. It was a marvelous and diverse flora, all based on the reproduction by spores. And
now, would you explain that for those of us who don't know?
Of course, yeah. So spore plant reproduction is really quite different from seed plant reproduction. If you look at something like a fern, you might find one that is ripe, and you could shake the leaf, and from below will be a cloud of these brown dust-like spores that are emitted. And each one of those spores is quite different from a seed. The spore contains the exact genetic blueprint of the parent plant. No sexual reproduction has taken place yet in those fern spores. And for the sexual reproduction...
Oh, wait a minute. We have to take a quick break, but sexual reproduction is the perfect reason for people to stay tuned to the food chain. Michael Olson here with Tor Hansen, two Vikings, talking about seeds, and you as well. 831-479-1080. We're going to learn how plants learn to make love when we come back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, folks, before there were the birds and the bees, which, of course, when you talk about birds and the bees, you're talking about seeds and eggs. But before there were seeds and eggs, there were spores. And how did the world get along with spores, Tor?
Well, we were right in the midst of it, weren't we, trying to get these spore plants to have sex. And we're sort of familiar with the idea of seed plant reproduction and that we have flowers and the bees pollinating the flowers, and it's really beautiful, sexy-looking stuff right out in the open. But for the spore plants, if we're following that fern spore we were talking about, spore plant sex usually happens in the dark, in the mud, and often with themselves. The spore lands someplace. It has to be in a place that has moisture. And that spore grows into another plant that we never even see. It doesn't look like the adult fern that we're used to. This separate generation is a tiny little plant about the size of your thumbnail somewhere in the mucky ground far away or close to that parent fern. That separate generation then produces the eggs and the sperm. The sperm have to swim through the wet soil, find those eggs, and then unite and grow into a fern as we know it. So it's a very...
You're right. It doesn't sound so exciting.
It's not nearly as sexy and wild as the pollination that we see in our most familiar garden plants. This is a different system. But it's the ancestral system, and this is how the seeds evolved from that system. Rather than having this all happen in a separate place, the spore plants that led to the seeds basically developed separate spores for the female spores and the male spores.
Is there any speculation as to, you know, what triggered that magnificent occurrence so long ago?
Yeah, well, I'm going to list for you a number of traits that evolved over the course of that gave the seed plants such an advantage. But that first step was to make a female spore that could then remain on the parent plant while the male spores evolved into pollen that then continued then to disperse through the landscape. So holding on to the female spores led to the seeds, and they were pollinated then by the pollen that was the result of the male spore evolution. So once you did that, then you're in a position to start imbuing those seeds with a list of traits that gave them real advantages. And the first one is the nutrition that was then packed in with that plant embryo. A botanist will call a seed a baby plant in a box with its lunch, which is a marvelous way to think about a seed. It says a lot of what makes seeds so unique and successful. They have that nutrition in there to fuel the initial germination and growth of the baby plant. And that's something that the spore plants didn't have.
They had to land in the right place or they were toast.
They had to land in just the right spot. And that's why, in one of the reasons why spores are so prolific, millions upon millions upon millions of spores cast off by a single fern plant. They're just tiny, like little motes of dust. No nutrition, no real great investment in them. The idea is to make so many that you hope that maybe one or two will land in the right magical place to allow their reproduction to continue. So seeds had a greater investment. They invest the plants over evolutionary time, invested nutrition and energy into that seed, and then they needed to protect it. So the seeds had some kind of a shell, or they had a whole suite of chemicals used for defenses, and those have given rise to, you know, all of the various spices and pharmaceuticals and stimulants that we enjoy from seeds. Those are all tied to that idea of chemical defense.
Or attraction, right?
And then, yes, attraction as well. So part of the unique feature of seeds then is how they're dispersed. And that has given us everything from the fleshy fruits that we enjoy eating, because those evolved merely to move seeds from place to place, to tempt animals like us into moving seeds around. And then also some of the nutrition in the seeds in a sort of delicate balancing act for the plant, trying to attract certain animals into dispersing those seeds, wanting to eat them, take them away from the parent plant. So you have dispersal, you have nutrition in the seeds, you have defense of the seeds, you have the whole concept of pollination, which is a system we can manipulate. You can't really do that with the old spore plants. You can't predictably change their features through plant breeding the way you can by manipulating the movement of pollen from one plant to another. And that's part of the reason we don't farm horsetails and ferns. We can't make them the way we want to, the way we can with seed plants.
We just have to accept them as they are. So you mentioned different kinds of seeds, of course. You mentioned grains, nuts, kernels, pulses, and pips. Want to go through them really quickly?
Yeah, so you have a whole variety of seeds, great variety. The smallest seeds in the world are the seeds of orchids, which are very dust-like and tiny in their own way, and that goes all the way up to the largest seed in the world, which is the seed of a plant called the double coconut, the Coco de Mer, which grows on only two islands out in the Seychelles archipelago in the Indian Ocean, and a full-grown double coconut seed can weigh more than 40 pounds, so 11 orders of magnitude larger than an orchid seed, and a whole suite of different types of seeds in between there. You have the grains, which are, generally speaking, the seeds of grasses, which, in fact, are the whole fruit of the grass. The whole fruit has been co-opted into serving a seed-like function. You have, and those are packed with starches and some protein and a very valuable food source for us. You have the nuts, which are generally very protein and fat-rich seeds, often from trees, whether it's, you know, almonds or walnuts or pecans, all of those popular edible nuts packed with proteins. You have a whole range of seeds that disperse by wind, and many of them have fluffy appendages on them or very interesting wings to travel through the air by wind. Some of those have led to, for example, the cotton industry. All of the cotton that we wear comes from the seed coat of a particular plant, a group of plants in the mallow family, the cotton plant. You have winged seeds that have led to the inspiration for certain aerodynamic shapes like the stealth bomber directly from a particular winged seed. So the whole variety of seeds in nature all tied to different ecological settings and functions and strategies for the parent plant that get that seed dispersed to the right place and the right point in time to germinate and grow.
So an almost innumerable set of purposes and objectives for the plants to survive provided people with all kinds of possibilities, right?
Yeah, so it is that great success in nature and sort of the evolutionary ingenuity of seeds to solve ecological problems for the plant in all these various ways. That diversity has led to a great diversity of uses.
And it's really the transitioning into the sexual reproduction by which nature could conduct many more experiments than spores, correct?
Yeah, so that system of reproduction for the seed plants and the great evolutionary pressure on reproduction, there's such a great deal at stake there that it provides a greater impetus from an evolutionary standpoint to change and innovate, has led to this great diversity of seed types.
So then we come to the point where people start to pick up these seeds and use them and develop them and cultivate them and select them and eat them and use them to make paint and all kinds of different things. But, you know, to do that, we had to undergo some metamorphosis as well. We had to go from becoming, I guess, a grass eater or whatnot to the cooking ape. And one of the more fascinating stories in seeds, the triumph of seeds, is the conjecture that, gosh, we might really have been made possible by learning how to cook these things. So when we come back, we're going to pick up that story with Tor Hansen, who is the author of The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips, boy, I bet I popped some peas on that one, conquered the plant kingdom and shaped human history. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, if you care to join us today, talk about seeds, the nature of life, I guess. Phone number today, 831-479-1980. 831-479-1980, right back. Well, folks, welcome back. Today we got two Vikings talking seeds, Tor Hansen, the author of The Triumph of Seeds, and Michael Olson, host of the Food Chain Radio program. And you think about seeds that provide 3/4 of the calories and over half the protein in our human diet. And they also provide for cosmetics, fuel, lubricants, medicines, and paints. You know, but for us to figure out how to use all of those seeds for all of those purposes, we had to develop some smarts. And before we go to the phone, we got Bill on Highway 1 with a very interesting question. I think we'll just pick him up right now. Bill, are you there?
Hey, Michael, how are you?
Very good. You got an interesting point to make about seeds. Go ahead.
Yeah, liability on seeds. Thor, you said that a seed is a little plant in a box with its lunch. So I assume that it's a living organism. However, they also go dormant. Are they alive when they're dormant and then do they die? Because if you plant a seed that's not viable, does that mean it's a dead seed? And question number two, I just have questions about treated seeds like Roundup Ready or those that are treated with other chemicals to make them more valuable in a certain circumstance.
Well, there you go. Thank you very much. I'll take you, put you on the air because you're on the cell phone, a little bit fuzzy. Well, what do you think, Tor? Are dormant seeds alive?
Wonderful question, Bill. Yeah, so I posed this very question to the director of our National Seed Bank in Fort Collins, Colorado, Chris Walters, who knows more about dormant seeds than just about anyone.
Because he has a lot of them, right?
Yeah, well, it's a woman, and she's taking care of over 2 billion of them there at the seed bank. And she told me something fascinating. She said that A dormant seed has no measurable metabolic activity. And I looked at her and I said, well, hey, you know, in biology, we have a word for things with no metabolism. We
dead. Call
them dead. And she said something fascinating. She said, well, if we know of things that are clearly alive, and seeds clearly are alive, if we know of things that are clearly alive that aren't metabolizing, then maybe we need to change our definition of what it means to be alive. And so it's a really fascinating puzzle where you have a dormant seed, this idea of dormant seed, that a live plant embryo can enter a state sort of like suspended animation that can last for a season or 5 seasons, 10 seasons, 20 seasons. We have seeds that the current record holder is a date pit that survived in that dormant state for close to 2,000 years. And yet...
And it came to life?
And came to life, a fascinating record-breaking story, but a date pit from an archaeological dig in Israel that some botanists planted, and lo and behold, it grew into a healthy date palm after close to 2,000 years buried in the rubble at that archaeological site. So it's still something that is mysterious in some ways, but the current thinking on how this works has to do with the loss of water, the desiccation that goes on in a truly dormant seed, and the remaining material inside those cells, or much of it, is what they call a bioglass, which is a glass-like structure made typically from a sugar, a starchy sugar substance, and that somehow manages to maintain not only the form, but the function of all of those little organelles that make a plant work, make a plant cell work, so that when you add water back to that seed at the point of germination and it floods into that cell, the organelles not only know where they should be, but they remember how to work. And it's still somewhat mysterious, but people are studying this for all sorts of uses, including the development of dry vaccines, trying to freeze-dry vaccines in a dry bioglass state using myo-inositol, which is a sugar extracted from rice grains.
Wow. Regarding the second question, I think I'd like to hold off on that until we get toward the end of the program when we talk about our use of seeds. But I'd like to go back to the beginning and talk about how, you know, what gave us the ability to think about how to cultivate seeds and develop agriculture. And you told a wonderful story about the cooking ape. You want to relate that one?
Sure. So one of the great thinkers on this topic is a fellow named Richard Wrangham at Harvard, who is an anthropologist. And he spent years studying chimpanzees. He studied with Jane Goodall and went on and did a great amount of work on his own in Uganda studying chimps. And at one point, he was following these wild chimps around in the forest and thought, well, you know, these are our closest relations in the animal kingdom. And he was studying their diet, and he thought, well, why can't I just eat what they're eating? So he decided he would try this. He would just go out in the woods. He wouldn't take a lunch with him for his field days, and he'd just eat what the chimps were eating. And he said, God, he could barely last a day or two doing this. He was just starving because the chimps were eating, you know, all of this variety of fruit and vegetation, but all in a raw form. And he was eating it, but not able to get enough energy out of that to get through his day. And it got him thinking about the importance of cooking and what that innovation may have meant for our ancestors. So then began a whole series of experiments on the nutrition from food and how it changes when it's cooked. And so you learn quickly that a raw diet is very limiting, in a sense, for our physiology. Whereas if you cook the food that we eat, we're able to glean a lot more nutrition from it, whether it's seeds crushed up or leaf matter or tubers, or whether it is meat that has been hunted. If it's cooked, we can get a lot more nutrition out of it. And Richard and colleagues came up with the theory that that was an important step in our own evolution in terms of being able to afford larger brain size and the great metabolic demands of a large brain. We have to be cooking food to be able to support that great great expenditure of energy on our brains.
And had we not developed the idea about cooking, we would have to spend most of the day chewing.
Yeah, they did a wonderful calculation of how much of our time we'd have to spend chewing, processing food by chewing, if we were to even survive, you know, really on a raw diet in the wild. There are some folks who do a raw diet nowadays, you know, with the convenience of fully stocked grocery stores nearby, which of course is something that you don't have in a wild state. But even people on that diet, what they've learned from studies is that many women on that diet cease menstruating and in fact are no longer, the body no longer has the energy to reproduce, which in from a biological standpoint tells you you're probably not getting enough nutrition.
Well, with all of this newfound smarts that we got from eating cooked food, grains, I guess it was the whole spectrum of things we were cooking, right?
Yes, absolutely. Cooking was quickly applied to tubers, to meat and nuts and other sorts of seeds. One of the earliest signs of human use of fire that we have, or pre-human, it was our genus, but a previous species, was a site in Israel 700,000 or 800,000 years old. There's a fire pit that they found. And one of the things from that fire pit was a charred barley grain. Even way back in that time, wild barley being charred.
They were probably making beer. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. When we get back, we're going to talk about what we did with our newfound smarts and how we learned how to take the seeds of grass and turn it into agriculture and turn agriculture into civilization. Do stay tuned. Well, you think about it, we've been growing crops for a long, long time. What you said, 200,000 years we were cooking up barley, Tor?
That particular site was 700,000 to 800,000 years old.
So a long, long time we've been looking to seeds for our nourishment. And I just got to thinking, you've been around the world looking at life and biology. Why is it that so much seemed to happen in the Middle East, the Fertile Crescent, the area around Israel and Egypt? What was it? Why are you there?
Oh, great question. And there's no one answer to that. But there was an interesting study done some years ago about grains and looking to wild grains and simply mapping where are the grains, the wild grasses with the largest seeds. And a whole bunch of them just happened to occur in the Fertile Crescent. So if you're looking at places where grains were domesticated, where grasses were domesticated, some of the best ones happen to be, some of the fattest wild grains happen to be in that area, and that, in some people's minds at least, led to, you know, just by the chance of where those things grew, many of our grains came from that place, and it started early. And one of the interesting things about our history in agriculture is to think about what archaeologists do when they're trying to pinpoint in time the period where a culture transferred from hunter-gatherer subsistence to agriculture. And as they're sifting through the dirt in an archaeological site, they look, for example, at the remnants of wild seeds, wild grains, for example, in the dirt. People may have been harvesting wild grains for a long time and eating them, and then all of a sudden there's a place somewhere in that strata of dirt where the seeds start getting bigger. They jump in size. And as soon as the archaeologists see that in the seeds, they know that people had begun to select particular seeds. And you can do this yourself if you are gardening in your backyard and you decide to grow any plant for seed. The plant that you choose probably has some particular character. If you grow a whole row of tomato plants, you're probably going to save seed from the one that had the sweetest tomatoes or that produced the most tomatoes. Similarly, for people starting with wild grains, they chose the large seeds to plant, and then every year, every harvest afterward, kept selecting seeds of a certain quality, the fattest seeds. And you can see this, of course, in the archaeological record, a clear sign of when domestication began for a huge array of wild seeds.
You know, some time ago, I read an article about a tourist location. Somebody set up a tourist trap and somewhere in the Fertile Crescent, in the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates. And it was the original Garden of Eden. And what you say about the grasses growing there, maybe there's some truth to that notion, that that's where the Garden of Eden was.
Yeah, well, you can certainly pinpoint early transition from hunter-gatherer to a gardening sort of setting. One thing that's interesting, too, though, to keep in mind, we tend to think of that as something that happened overnight. This, we call it the agricultural revolution, right? And suddenly we learned how to farm. But the one place where they have a really clear archaeological record is from a site in Syria that's now been inundated by a dam, but it was carefully excavated decades ago. And there was a place where there was continual occupation from when it was simply a hunter-gatherer camp all the way through the period of time until that the people living there were living completely off of farming. And very interesting that it went from, you know, perhaps 200 species of wild plants used when it was hunter-gatherers down to about 20 or between 10 and 20 when they were farming. But the other interesting thing is that it didn't happen overnight. It took over 1,000 years for that full transition to take place. So there was a long period of time where our ancestors were farming some, hunting some, farming a little more. Maybe it changed over the decades, depending on the climate and the conditions, until finally that full transition had been made.
And of course, we were smart enough to figure out how to grow enough grain to sustain a lot of people. And grain then became an instrument of government control, leading to such things as the bread and circuses, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the phrase bread and circus, you know, comes from Rome, and there was a dole. There was a free grain distribution annually to citizens of Rome, and people, you know, a social critic at the time called this, you know, appeasing the masses with bread and circuses, you know, entertainments, the gladiators and what have you, and free bread. And there's a direct link to, you know, again, to grain as something that can be given away or that can be taxed or that can be, you know, stored for long periods of time. It comes straight out of that dormancy question we were talking about with your caller. That's a unique characteristic of these seeds, that you can store them. And if they can be stored, then they can be stolen, and so you have to defend against them. If they can be stored, they can be taxed. So it leads to, or tends to lead to, a great development of social complexity and hierarchies and group defense and all of these things, all rooted in, ultimately, the biology of seeds.
And anthropologist Jared Diamond talked about the curse of agriculture in how it tends to limit biological diversity. And so when we come back, I guess I'd like to pick that up with you and ask, can we cooking apes figure out how to save enough biological diversity to ensure a future for Noah and his children and all of our children? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Tor Hansen. And you got a few minutes, 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. Welcome back out there. Michael Olson, few minutes left. So much to talk about. Right now we have Richard on the line with a perfect question for the Norwegian seed guy. Richard, fire away. Are you there, Richard? Let's see.
Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Try.
There you can. I think it's really awesome that people are willing to step out and protect the seed lines, because nobody else is going to care about them, right?
Well, that's the notion. You know, agriculture is the great selector of a few good seeds. And it's all about the purpose of being, you know, of the growing of the plant. But in that selection, we take fewer and fewer and fewer seeds all the time.
But there's very few people that are willing to put up the money to store the seeds in an area where I think we can believe nobody will hurt them. In other words, keep the seeds in a really cold environment where they're able to be kept. And I don't think very many people are willing to keep up that money. Brit exit.
Great question. Well, what do you think, Tor? Can we save enough genetics to get by in the future? Or are we saving so few genetics that we're going to put ourselves in a fix here?
Well, it is a terrific question, and it gets at what has really become a very important movement, the seed-saving movement. And as you were mentioning, you know, for generations, we've all been seed savers, you know, our ancestors, year after year, selecting and developing a huge variety of particular local races of all of our food crops. You know, everything was grown in small amounts in people's little farms and backyards around the world. And so you have all of these varieties specifically adapted to certain conditions. That really started to change in the last 50, 60, 70 years when we transformed from a small agricultural local system to more of an industrial system where we grow a very few varieties on a grand scale. And what people began to realize is that we're losing the agricultural heritage of all of this genetic diversity, of all of these crop varieties adapted to their local conditions. And so people began to gather those seeds wherever they could and store them in seed banks. And there's a Norwegian now, a project, well, international, but located in Norway, in the archipelago of Svalbard. They call it the Doomsday Vault, a vault drilled into the side of a mountain in the Arctic where duplicate copies of many of these seed varieties are being stored from seed banks around the world, just as another backup sort of insurance measure, because we know we're going to need this genetic diversity of all of our crops, particularly now in a period of rapid climate change where, you know, we cannot rely on a very few varieties when things are changing so fast, and we're going to need to be able to access seed banks and to access wherever we do have diversity growing in agricultural systems or even in nature, the wild relations of these plants to breed the crops of the future.
Who can do that?
Well, we get this idea in our head that a seed bank or a seed vault is something where you put the seeds in and lock the door and walk away. But it's actually a very active situation where those seeds, you know, they deteriorate over time.
We just ran out of time. So, in other words, we have to do it ourselves.
You're absolutely right. We all play a part. So we play a part when we shop, too. Buy diversity of seeds so that we can grow diversity.
Tor Hansen, thank you so much. Seeds, get it. Enjoy it. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain? Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.